I'm really pleased to have Anna here. We have a copy of her book in the library, but
we need our own, right?
it has been checked out and on hold ever since we got it, so I haven't even had a chance to look at it. So it's circulating really well. But Anna's over in the Dungannon vicinity over there, not exactly in Dungannon. And I think you've been living there 6 years?
Yeah.
Okay. And she's a former biologist or botanist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to let her tell you all about her new book.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I guess I should start off by telling you that my book's called The Weekend Homesteader, and I feel like I should explain the term homesteading before I delve into anything because it confuses some people. Of course, some people think that when I talk about homesteading, I mean I'm going to move out west onto the prairie and carve a farm out of the wilderness, and then in a few years the government will give me all the land, which unfortunately you can't do anymore. So homesteading nowadays means something slightly different. The idea is very different, but kind of the spirit of it's the same. Homesteaders are still trying to be self-sufficient. They're still trying to do a lot of things themselves, but they may be doing it in the city. They may be doing it in an established farm. There's actually a whole new genre of what's called urban homesteading, where people live in a high rise in the city. They have honeybees on the roof. They might have rabbits in the garage of their suburban house or tomatoes on their balcony. So you can do this anywhere you want. And my book does some of the things in this book will require you to have a little bit of land, but some things you can do right there, even if you have absolutely no land. Even if you don't have a balcony, you can have a worm bin under your kitchen sink and compost all your food scraps and turn them into compost that you can then use. I guess if you don't have any land, you couldn't use that compost. But you can give it to someone, they'd really like it. So that's what homesteading is. And I guess I should run real quickly through why you might choose to homestead. There are a lot of different reasons. The biggest reason, and the reason Mark, this is my husband Mark, by the way. the reason we got into it is because we really like the idea of having something much nicer than we could afford. Everybody probably knows that you can't buy real tomatoes in the grocery store, right?
Amen to that.
Well, there are a lot of other things when you start getting into homesteading that you realize you can't buy in the grocery store, you know. Once you start, everybody was talking about the Man Farm strawberries when we moved here. I thought they were the best thing ever. Last spring, they always come about 2 weeks before mine. I was waiting for my strawberries and waiting for my strawberries, so we bought some Man Farm strawberries. And we couldn't really even eat them. They didn't taste good anymore. Ours are so much better than that, which is one of the problems with homesteading. Once you get into it, you can't really go back. But that's one of the big reasons to start homesteading. Another reason would be, of course, to save money. If you're growing your own tomatoes or strawberries, you don't have to pay $10 a gallon for the strawberries in the grocery store. And the last reason might be environmental sustainability. The other reasons are easier to understand, but homesteading can help the environment in a lot of different ways. If you imagine a tomato canning facility versus you canning tomatoes in your kitchen, the tomato canning facility is probably going to take out the skins and the seeds, and they're going to send that to the landfill. On our farm, if we take out the skins and the seeds, they go to the chickens, and then the next morning we eat them as eggs. And if you don't have chickens, they can go in the worm bin, and then it'll turn into compost, and it'll feed your tomatoes for next year, so you're growing your own tomatoes out of tomatoes. So those are just a few reasons you might be interested in homesteading. There are a lot of different things that can be involved in homesteading. I'm going to talk a lot about growing things, because as Charlie mentioned, plants are my thing. I really like them. And so everything comes back to plants for me. But growing your own food isn't the only aspect of homesteading. Some people really get into the energy independence side. They'll put up solar panels or a little windmill or something like that. Or they'll do passive solar water heaters. There are all kinds of different things you can get into. Other people get into making a living at home so you don't have to go to work in this terrible library. But I hope that nobody hears.
I was going to say, don't give me any ideas.
No, we love this library, so you can't start homesteading, but other people can. So before I delve into the meat of my talk, I thought I'd get a feel for the people here and see what kinds of homesteading related topics you all are into or interested in. Does anybody here have a garden of any kind?
We have grow organic tomatoes and a variety of other things.
That sounds delicious. Do you grow?
Yeah, I do a mini garden with our 4-H.
That's nice. Does anybody here have chicken? Y'all can come on in or you can go.
We have to go home and milk our goats.
Does anybody here have chickens? No, that's probably beyond.
No, but if my husband would build me a real pretty coop, I've seen some beautiful coops, I'd have some. And I live right downtown, but I would.
My brother-in-law wants them, and his wife, my sister, says no.
Well, the people who live in town, you might be interested in chicken tractors. I don't know if you've heard of that.
Or that you move around.
Yep, it's like a little coop, and you just pull it. And those can be really cute.
I've seen some really love that.
Beautiful chicken tractors. Yeah. I keep thinking about making one for my mom, but we were just discussing on the drive up. I don't think it's going
to
fly.
My neighbor's got a rooster I'd like to bring to you.
Hey, I love to hear roosters.
Yeah, we need to learn to kill roosters. They're very tasty.
Okay.
All right, so is anybody interested in any other aspects of homesteading, or do you all do anything? Do you have rain barrels? Or?
I do. I just think it's interesting. I don't know how much I'll actually get around to doing, but I like to just hear about it so that I can decide what I want to do.
Sure.
Yeah.
That sounds good. Well, then it sounds like gardening is most people's alley. So that's probably what I'll spend the most time talking about. But I'm going to leave a lot of time for questions, and feel free to jump in at any point because I'm glad to have you all talk instead of me. So, you all probably, the ones of you who do have a garden, probably do what I did when I was a kid and what my parents did, which is about this time of year you go out with a rototiller and plow up the ground, or possibly you get your neighbor to come in with the plow and you plow up the ground, and then you plant tomatoes and corn and beans and a couple other things like that, and they grow, they look great for a couple of months, and then about September the weeds have taken over and the diseases have taken over and your garden kind of collapses. I don't know if that has happened to you.
Well, your garden might be better before, but I do better now.
You're better. A lot of people around here have that kind of garden, unfortunately. And when I started out, that's what I did, but I started trying a lot of different techniques and reading a lot of books about more environmental methods of gardening, and I came upon different ways that allowed us to have food all through the year, and also ways of getting more tastier food out of the garden that we have. We now grow, I'd say, 95% of our vegetables, and that's not just frozen and canned things in the winter. We're eating kale and lettuce and all kinds of things all through the winter months. The way we do that is through season extension, which I won't really go into because this isn't the time of year when you're probably thinking about that. You're probably thinking about starting a new exciting garden, but it's something to think about making it possible for your harvest to extend all through the winter. And I do mention in here something called quick hoops, which is a method where you use these PVC pipes to make little hoops about that tall, and then you cover it with row cover fabric, which you might know of as tobacco canvas. That's what we used to call it when I was a kid. You can't really get it around here anymore because people don't grow much tobacco, but you can get it online. And for about $50, you can cover an area maybe as big as this spot here, which will feed you a lot of kale through the winter. And what it does is the fabric lets rain come through and it lets sun come through and then the air go through. So it's like a mini greenhouse, but a little bit better, because with a greenhouse, when the sun comes in, it's going to overheat and it's also going to get too dry. So you have to do a whole lot of work. With a quick hoop, none of that happens. It kind of takes care of itself. If it's too hot, the hot air comes out. If it's too cold, the sun will come in, and it really boosts it up. And I'd say it kind of allows us to grow things that my father in South Carolina can grow over the winter. So it's not going to let you grow tomatoes over the winter, but if you want to grow something like kale or
Swiss chard or mustard greens or something like that. It'll give you that little extra bit of time.
I think some of our farmers who sell at the farmer's market use the hoops now.
I think they do.
Yeah.
There's also, that's sometimes called a low tunnel as well. There's also high tunnels, of course, like that are really greenhouses.
Yeah.
But I didn't make those ideas up. Those are by Elliot Coleman, who's a really amazing gardener up in, I believe, Maine. I'm not positive about where he's at, but he's worked around all these methods of getting season extension, because when you grow that far north, you have to work around
that's
the weather.
Right. Yeah.
So the other main difference between my garden and a lot of mainstream gardens is that we use what's called no-till methods. I don't know, has anybody here heard of no-till? No? I bet you can guess what it means, though.
I call it plastic, like the garden.
You could do that. I don't really recommend that because I feel like that blocks the oxygen to the soil. What you do instead is, I'll go ahead and tell you now. The way I start a new garden bed is, say, this area here was a lawn. I'll have Mark mow it really close. He does all the heavy work.
That's what he's for.
That's right. He's very good at it. So he'll mow it really close, and then we'll just lay down some cardboard, and then we'll lay down some straw. And if we do that in the fall, by this time, I'll just kind of push it back. The soil's bare. The worms have taken all that dead grass and stuff, worked it into the soil, and improved it. And it's just ready to plant into just like that. Of course, if you then leave the ground bare, you'll get a whole bunch of weeds. But if you then cover it with straw or some other kind of mulch, then you keep the weeds away. And you've got this system where you don't really have to disturb the soil at all, which is very important because there are a lot of problems that occur when you till up the ground. Now, of course, tilling does help in certain ways. Like, the reason we like to till is because it kills the weeds. Like, if you've left the ground bare all winter, by this time there's a whole bunch of weeds there you're going to have to kill. It helps you work in manures and things. But it also causes problems. Like, a lot of people, at least used to, they don't as much nowadays, would till in the fall and leave this tilled ground bare all winter. When you do that, every time it rains in the winter, it'll take a little bit of that topsoil away. And unfortunately, the topsoil is the really good stuff. So you keep losing the topsoil and your soil gets worse and worse and worse. So that's a problem with tilling. Another problem is kind of complicated. I don't know if anybody here has heard of mycorrhizal fungi. Yeah? Has anybody else? I'll explain it just in case. There's an amazing book that I highly recommend called Teeming with Microbes, which sounds really dull, but what it is these really very magnified pictures of these soil microorganisms that, of course, you couldn't see with your naked eye, but they blow it up and they also turn into this adventure story. I mean, it's not fiction, but it feels almost like fiction. You really don't believe it until you see what these scientists have discovered is in the soil. We think of it as just this inert, you know, stuff. It's just dirt. But if you really look deep in there, it's this amazing ecosystem. There are bacteria and fungi, and of course there are bigger things like worms and so forth. But when you look at the little tiny stuff, a lot of us think of bacteria and fungi, you're quite like, oh, I don't want that in my garden. But the truth is you actually do want that in your garden. There's some fungi in the soil, the mycorrhizal fungi that I was just talking about. What they do is pretend my fingers are the roots of your plant. So you just put this tomato in the ground. These mycorrhizal fungi actually latch on to each tiny root. And then they come out. So the root comes out to here from the tomato. The mycorrhizal fungi might go all the way out to there. So your tomato plant can get nutrients from this little tiny area. If they team up with these fungi, they can get nutrients all over this huge area. And there have even been studies that show that the mycorrhizal fungi, they're not wedded to a single plant. It'll latch on here, then it'll latch on this tomato. And if this tomato here is having a bad day, the fungus can actually take some food from that tomato and give it to this tomato. So it really makes everything a lot better. Of course, what the plant does is it gives the fungus a little bit of sugar, because the plants can photosynthesize, they can make their own sugars. The fungus can't, it needs something to eat. So they trade, the plant gives it a little sugar, and the fungus goes out here and gets a lot of phosphorus and other really important nutrients. So the reason I was going into that is when you till up the soil, fungi especially can handle that at all. As you churn the soil up, you break up those fungi. They really like to be in the very top of the soil. They get mixed down into the lower soil, they die, and your tomato, it only has this little bit of root area again. So it really improves the health of your soil not to till. Another reason you might not want to till is so that you don't lose organic matter. So probably anybody who's gardened knows that the really dark soil is the good stuff, right? And it's dark because it's full of organic matter. And organic matter, of course, is important because it slowly rots down and turns into all these nutrients your plants need. It also is a home for all those microorganisms we were talking about. It's just really good stuff. You always want that. When you till up the soil, what happens is the microorganisms that break down organic matter, they get a boost. So whereas the mycorrhizal fungi get hurt, the decomposers are really happy because they've got all this extra oxygen because you kind of fluffed up the soil. And what happens is they break down all that organic matter really fast. And so the first year you do that, it's awesome because your plants have this huge buffet of food that came from that organic matter. But unfortunately, after that, every year there's less and less and less because it's basically disappeared. And organic matter is supposed to very slowly decompose. If you don't till it up and make it all burn off really fast, and organic matter can be kind of a slow release food. But if you till it up, then you're basically just feeding the soil for that year, which you don't really want to do. You want to think of your soil as more of a bank account where you're going to live off the interest rather than a bank account where you're always, you know, overdrawing and you're living off your capital. All right. Another reason you wouldn't want to till up the soil is weeds. Now, I told you tilling destroys weeds. But tilling also helps weeds come back, because every time you churn up the soil, you bring more weed seeds to the surface. And usually seeds won't sprout unless they're, like, it depends on the seed, of course, but a lot of the weed seeds like to be up in the bright light. So if they're, like, down in the soil a little bit, they won't even sprout. But as you till up the soil, new ones come to the surface. So every year you have more weed seeds. You're like, geez, I keep tilling this garden, it keeps getting more weeds. Well, that's why, because you're tilling the garden. Another reason you might not want to till the garden is to prevent soil compaction. And most of you who garden probably know that you don't want to till it when it's too wet, you don't want to till it when it's too dry. But even if you're really careful and you only till it at just the right spot, once you till it up, you break apart these soil aggregates, which again go back to those really interesting soil microorganisms. Different ones, you know, I keep telling you about new soil microorganisms. This is yet another kind. These guys like to bind soil together. So all these little particles, if you look in the soil, it's really just little pieces of silt and sand and clay, little tiny pieces. That's before you bring the life in. Once you bring the life in, they start binding those things together. Bacteria actually produces glue that glues them into particles. And the great thing about that is it glues it into particles with air spaces in between. The air spaces mean when the roots get down there, they're able to breathe. They're also, the water will go through there, so your plants are able to suck up water. But when you till up the soil again, those microorganisms die. I sound like a broken record. And you no longer have these amazing aggregates. You just have that basic soil, and that's very easy to compact. And when it compacts down, you run out of air, you run out of the ability to hold water, so it's just not a good idea. And the final thing that can happen is crusting. This might not happen in your garden. It happened in ours the first year. We tilled up the soil. I didn't know about no-till yet. And we've got very clayey soil. And so it turned it into this dust almost on the surface. And the first time it rained, we get such heavy rains around here, it came down, it kind of pounded on that. And the little tiny particles went into all the soil pores, and suddenly I had this crust of dirt on top of the ground. And even when it rained later in the summer, the rain couldn't get through. It just ran off because I'd formed this crust, and so I had to go through and carefully break that apart and put a mulch on it. Really helps.
I have a crust on mine, so is that what you do?
Yeah, wait until it's dry and then just kind of like go through with a hoe or your fingers and just break apart that little top part and then mulch over it, and it'll be...
What kind of mulch?
I like straw mulch for the vegetable garden. It's kind of expensive. But
I have a little garden, so it'll be okay.
Oh, okay. And is it all vegetables?
Uh-huh.
Then straw is what I would do. If you're going into trees or like raspberries or something like that, then I would recommend moving over to something woodier, like rotted wood chips or tree leaves or something like that. All right, so those are all the reasons you would not want to till your garden. And the main other reason is it just doesn't taste as good. You would think that homegrown tomatoes would taste the same no matter how you grow them, but it's not true. If you do no-till, you feed them. Rather than feeding them fertilizer, you feed them, we like to feed them rotted horse manure. That's our favorite. You get the best tasting food ever.
Well, sure, don't have any of that.
All right, and before I go on, I should mention... So you don't eat tomatoes?
It makes me want to eat tomatoes.
Well, everything else tastes good too. It's just that this time of year, all I can think about is tomatoes. So I should mention that I'm singing all these praises of no-till, but it's very different from what you would talk to a farmer about. Some farmers on a large scale do no-till, and I don't really recommend industrial no-till, because what they do is rather than these methods I'm using, they come in there and they spray it all down with herbicides, and then everything's dead, and they can just plant it into the ground without tilling.
Isn't that harmful, though?
It's very harmful. I definitely don't recommend that. But you may hear someone talking about no-till, and they might be talking about that. So just be aware as you go out.
My son wanted to spray around, you know, where I've got some weeds and things, and I said no.
No, I really don't recommend it. We always lay down kill mulches instead, which is what I was describing before, where you just lay down the cardboard and so forth. All right, so I guess that's the basics of no-till gardening. And in here, I mentioned some of the easiest crops to grow, which one of which is these Egyptian onions, which I brought in, and I'm hoping everybody will take at least one home, but don't feel obliged. I was describing these before to a couple of you, but not all of you. These were actually descended from some onions that my great aunt used to grow in Massachusetts. She used to write for Organic Gardening Magazine, so clearly it just kind of ran in our family. And they're amazing little onions. You don't really eat. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm kidding.
You grew those already this year?
Yes. See, the thing is, they're perennials, so over the winter, they're kind of growing, and then about a month ago, they start sending up a lot of shoots. You don't really eat them all, you can, but if you do, it's no longer a perennial, obviously. If you don't eat the bulb, then what you can do is snip leaves off whenever you want. I try to always leave two leaves on the plant at all times. That way it doesn't die. But you can just keep cutting the green onions all year. I think probably about January and February we don't get many. But other than that, it's a year-round sort of thing. And I'm going to pass this around with some bags here so you can kind of...
I already have some.
Oh, well, then I'll have some more.
Yeah, well, come on. But they are big and beautiful right now.
They are.
And you would believe how good they look all winter. And the little tops come down, and when they touch, they grow more.
I should have mentioned that. It's also called a walking onion because the tops do walk like that.
Are they real strong?
Taste-wise? I feel like they taste a little bit like garlic.
Oh, I would love that.
I've
not eaten any yet.
You haven't eaten any?
How
did you get started?
My husband in hardware store gave them to
him. Oh, okay.
And so he just planted them as an experiment.
Uh-huh.
And so then we've been watching them grow, and it's like, we kind of don't know what to do with them.
Uh-huh.
But now I know to cut off the tops.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want to do.
That's what I do.
Exactly like chives. Yeah, I have chives, and that's what I do with my chives.
They are very much like chives in a way.
Yeah.
And I do warn you, they'll kind of take over. They don't take over like one of those plants like mint where you can't rip it out. But they produce so many top balls. And if you try to compost the top balls, you just get a... onions in your compost before all these things. I was weeding the garden. This is not actually a present. This is our weed. Happy to meet you all.
It's called sharing.
That's right. Sharing our weed.
weeds are good.
Well, now, if you don't yield a garden, you can do that since you're so cheap. You make the soil loose and everything.
Yeah, that's a good question. How exactly do we plant into it? So I told you about this beginning, like how I laid down the kill mulch and then I raked it back. And this time of year what I do is I top dress. I don't know if y'all know what that means. It means you throw things on top. You throw a lot of compost on top of the soil. And you just, sometimes I'll leave a lot of, kind of depends on what I'm planting. If I'm planting something like a set, like a broccoli set or a tomato set, I'll just, you know, dig a tiny little hole, put it in, and then put some mulch around it, and I'm done. If I'm planting seeds, I'll likely rake the compost, I mean, coat the compost into the ground, just like into the top inch or so. But you don't want it to go very deep. The worms will start working it pretty soon. But if you just leave compost on the cool surface for them to dry out, you don't want that.
Do you grow your own worms too, or harvest them, or whatever you call it?
Yeah, we do. We grow compost worms. They're a little different than the worms in your garden, but we grow a lot of worms in the garden too. We don't, you know, we don't try to grow them. They just come. Whenever you have a band of matter, worms will come. Well, it's actually, some people call that a worm test. If you dig up a spade of dirt and then you kind of crumble it apart and you see how many worms are in that, that's kind of a way of measuring the quality of your soil.
So the more worms, the higher.
The more worms, the better. And of course, it's different from different times of year. You dig it in February, you're not going to see as many worms. Although, I was out there weeding in March and we were seeing an awful lot of worms.
Wow. How many would you start out with, depending on your garden, I guess?
Do you mean putting worms in your
garden? Introduce them to the
garden? You shouldn't need to introduce any worms to your garden. They'll come if you start using these techniques. Now, when you till up the soil, it kills the worms usually because it breaks them apart. So you will lose a lot if you do that. The more you do no-till, you'll get so many worms, you don't have to add any.
Wow, I don't think I have any worms because
I'm not sure I'm
going to buy them.
I've killed them. You've got them, baby. Yeah, you just haven't been murderer. Down the sidewalk.
Yeah, I don't even see them too much anymore.
We'll weigh some nut dollars.
Are we calling them nut dollars?
Yeah. Well, while we're talking about worms, that is one of the other really easy techniques that I mentioned in here as a basic homesteader technique. I didn't really explain much about the book because I wanted to talk to you about no-till gardening before I got sidetracked. But I should tell you that basically what I did was I picked a project for each weekend of the year, only I only did 48 projects, I figured you need some time off. And each project is supposed to be something you can do easily on a weekend afternoon, so it's not going to eat up your whole life, it's just a little time. And one of those techniques is to create a worm bin. That's one that I would really recommend, especially if you've got kids or if you've got anybody in your life. I think worms are awfully cute. They're very photogenic. They really kind of draw people in, except for the people who hate worms.
I don't know what you've got against them, but I didn't want to touch them.
You'll start liking them if you do a worm, and that's one of the easy things. Like, this is all full of easy things, but the very, very easy things. I'd say the worm bin, a very simple garden, isn't really that easy, but it's probably one of the most important, so I put it in the top easy things. Learning to cook in season is awfully important because it kind of sucks you into growing more of your own food. If you know how to cook with kale, I have a lot of friends who subscribe to CSAs. Y'all know what that is? Community supported agriculture. In bigger cities, they're often farmers who put out flyers to all the community, and people sign up in the spring, and they say, I'm going to give you this amount of money, and you're going to give me a basket of food once a week, and it's whatever you can grow. If the tomatoes die of the blight this year, I won't get any tomatoes, but if you have a huge crop of green beans, I'm going to have a lot of green beans.
So mustard greens all year long.
That's right. There are a lot of greens in the CSA, and that's what my friends always told me. They come to me and they say, Anna, I've signed up for the CSA, and it was great, except all they're giving me is greens. They're giving me kale, they're giving me mustard greens and lettuce. I don't know what to do with all this stuff. And so it is a very important thing to learn to do, is to cook in season. And an easy way to do it is just to go to the farmer's market and see what they've got, because that's probably in season. And the more you do that, the more likely you are to grow, because greens are some of the easiest things to grow. So it'll start making you think, oh, I could have grown that, and it'd be even better.
Do you market some of your stuff?
We don't. We only cook for our, I mean, grow for ourselves. And then as it starts getting more complicated, I'd say chickens are kind of on the semi-easy list. Mark will tell me they're not that easy, but they just mix in with everything so well. A lot of this book, I don't really use the word permaculture. Have you all heard of that term? Maybe one or two of you. Permaculture is short for permanent agriculture, and it's a technique that came out of Australia in, I think, the 80s or the 70s. It's just kind of starting to hit the U.S., though, so you don't hear it much. The way my parents talked about organic gardening, now people talk about permaculture. Organic gardening kind of hit the mainstream. It got watered down, and so the people who are really gung-ho were like, well, we're going to have to think of a new name for this because, because organic gardening no longer says what we want it to say. So they came up with permaculture. And in permaculture, you're always thinking about connections and ways of making things do more than one thing. And the reason I add chickens to the list is because in permaculture, chickens are so important. They can eat that all those scraps I was telling you about and make compost. They can, of course, make food for you. And they can even scratch some weeds out of your garden and things like that. So those are the top things I would recommend starting with.
So do you put that chicken manure when you clean your coops and things, you put that on your garden?
We do. We actually use a method we call deep bedding in our chicken coop. So rather than just letting the chickens poop right on the ground, we lay a lot of bedding in there, which will depend on what we have at that time of year. Dried tree leaves are one of my favorites, like if you just rake up the leaves in the fall and throw those in there. It's all about, it gets kind of complicated, the carbon to nitrogen ratio. Like a lot of people don't like chickens because they think they stink, and they do if you do them wrong. But if you add this deep bedding in there, it's very high in carbon, and when the high in nitrogen manure hits that carbon, it just turns into compost. So what we do is we do this deep bedding method, and then we clean that mixture out, and we put that at the base of our berry trees, and I mean our berry bushes and our fruit trees.
How long does that take to compost the leaves and things if you do that?
Chickens are really good at scratching things up. So the faster, things will compost faster if you break it into small pieces. So when chickens are involved, it usually happens faster. I have to admit, we never let it go all the way there. After about 3 or 4 months, I need it. I always need more organic matter, and so I put it on the garden, and that's fine. It's more of a mulch at that point.
You don't have a tongue for it.
No. But it really depends on whether you're willing to let it wait all the way till it composts.
Well, it'll continue even when you put it out around.
It does. It really does. So that was the basic stuff about homesteading I wanted to tell you about, but I also wanted to tell you just a little bit about the story of the book, which may either inspire you or bore you, so we'll see. The reason I wanted to tell you about that is because I suspect that a lot of you all might have dreamed of writing a book. I know both my parents are English majors. I grew up with books all over my outhouse, the house too, but you know. Even the outhouse was covered with books. You'd go out there and read for hours. Everything was about books. So my dream from the time I was 04, that's when I started reading, was that I was going to write my own book. So I started writing these novels when I was, maybe 10. They were really terrible. And I knew that one day I was going to be published. And I did what budding authors do, and I sent all these query manuscripts out. Got all these rejection letters because it was really terrible. And then I kind of moved on with life. I was like, yeah, I'll keep writing things, but I'm not going to send these out. It's kind of breaking my heart. And about 6 years ago, we moved to the farm, and we started doing all this homesteading stuff, and suddenly I had all this stuff I wanted to write about. So I was writing all this stuff that was no longer bad novels, but was okay nonfiction. And I started putting it up on Amazon as ebooks. I saw someone had.
I did. Well, that's how I found out you wrote, was I discovered it on Amazon.
That's right. I think I saw it. You had. I didn't notice it was a Kindle or a Nook.
It is a Kindle.
So I started putting things up on there. And what's amazing about Amazon is that if you just give it a little nudge, your book can go up into the top 100 in your category, because they've got all these categories. And suddenly, random strangers can start seeing your book. So I've been spending so much time back when I was a lot younger trying to market my book. And when I kind of gave up on that and I just threw it up on Amazon, I stopped marketing and I just started writing. And it went up there. People saw it. And the editor from Skyhorse, which is the publishing company I published this through, they emailed me out of the blue. They'd seen it in the top 100 list on gardening, and they wanted to know if I wanted to turn it into a book. And to be honest, my initial reaction was, no, actually, I'm really liking this self-publishing thing. It's kind of nice. And I do really recommend it. If anybody has anything that you want to share with the world, it's very easy, and it doesn't cost anything. But Mark kind of talked me into experimenting with it. And so I went ahead and we played around with it, turned it into a paperback, and now it's in Tractor Supplies and in bookstores and so forth. But I just thought I'd tell you that so that you would know that it's very easy. It's not as hard as you think. And